Welcome, everybody.
There we go.
Hi. Thanks for coming, everybody. My name is Tim Lorden. I'm the executive director of the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. I need to speak up a little bit. Is that the idea? It does work.
Get closer to it.
Okay. Can anyone hear me now? Can you hear me now? Just a little wireless joke there, sorry. So this is what we're calling State of the Net West. We host this with our partner, Santa Clara Law School, the High Tech Law Institute here, with Professor Eric Goldman. And we've been doing this for about 6 years now, trying to bridge the kind of dialogue between Washington and Silicon Valley and San Francisco as well. Didn't want to leave you out. And you know, the idea is that both of these communities matter greatly to one another. Washington matters to Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley matters greatly to Washington and the overall economy for everybody. So it's been kind of a hard sell over the past like 6 or 7 years trying to kind of reinforce that idea that what happens in Washington matters to you, and what happens here in the marketplace and in the Valley matters back in Washington. Recently, we've had some legislative kerfuffles in Washington around intellectual property issues and a few other issues. I think the idea that these communities need each other is resonating more and more. So we're thrilled this year to do the State of the Net West project with Santa Clara High Tech Law Institute. And what we plan on doing was bring a variety of different policymakers from Washington, mostly members of Congress, to here into the Valley and then perhaps up to San Francisco to kind of engage in these kind of technology town hall meetings with kind of the technology constituents that Congress needs to kind of be talking to. So we'll be doing several of these throughout the year. This is our first one this year. We did 4 last year. And we hope that in the wake of maybe some of this copyright legislation and kind of an awakening of how important things are that happen in Washington are, we'll get more and more members to come out. Our next town hall meeting is on May 24th in Palo Alto with Congressman Jason Chaffetz from the House Judiciary Committee, who played a prominent role in the kind of Stop Online Piracy Act debate. And we'll be going forward with Congressman Goodlatte, who's also going to be an important player in that debate as well. And also we have local favorites, Congresswoman Anna Eshoo and Congressman Lofgren. And then we also have, for the first time, a Federal Trade Commissioner. We have Federal Trade Commissioner Julie Brill will be here sometime in the late summer, early fall. And we'll post those dates as soon as we have them. Commissioner Brill heads up the commission at the Federal Trade Commission, and there's a tremendous amount of privacy activity going on and probably going into the next Congress. That'll be really important to folks here in the Valley and in San Francisco. So stay tuned for that. I wanted today, we're very pleased to have a local hero, Congressman Mike Honda, who's the co-chair of our wireless task force for the Congressional Internet Caucus. Congressman Honda is on the Appropriations Committee and the Budget Committee, which really drive fiscal policy for the United States Congress, and frankly, that's largely what it does. It's fiscal policy and help drive some of the issues that you're dealing with here in the Valley. The congressman is beloved by just about everybody I meet. I'll be in random situations, and they'll say, "Well, I had him as a teacher way back," or "He was the superintendent of my school," or things like that. So every time I run into somebody, they always have fantastic things to say about the congressman. He also is his Democratic caucus. He's the co-chair of the New Media Working Group, so he does quite a bit on that. He's won several Golden Mouses, which is given out by a Washington organization that kind of credits members of Congress for really, really good websites. He's gotten a couple of Golden Mouse Awards, of which I'm sure he's extremely proud. So the format for today is town hall style. The congressman's going to make some comments about issues related to STEM education, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and workforce development, which is really a key issue here, and also is really driven by the Congress's fiscal policy, which he has had a lot of fingers in. And then we'll kind of talk about maybe the legislative developments on things like the copyright policy and things like that. We have Dana Ditmore, who's from Oak Valley Consulting. He's been working very much on the kind of STEM issues from a nonprofit perspective over many years. And then we have Professor Eric Goldman, who I mentioned earlier, who has just been promoted to full professorship here at the university. Once the congressman gets done with his remarks, Dana and Eric are going to fill in some of the gaps, and then we'd like to have kind of some questions and have a town hall back and forth with the congressman and the folks up here. So let me introduce Congressman Mike Honda.
Thank you, Jim. Can you hear me? Feels like church. Everybody's back there and nobody's up here. We're not going to ask you to give up your spirit or your soul or anything. You can hear me, okay? Okay. I just want to thank all of you for coming here to the kickoff of the 2012 State of the Net West. You know, punctuation is really important for me because when I read stuff, I run all the letters together, words together, and sometimes I really don't know what I'm reading. Santa Clara University is probably one of the foremost institutions of learning that I've really grown to appreciate, and President Ng here, I thought he was Vietnamese when I first heard his name. Yeah, it's the only Santa Clara guys know what that means. I told him that if I were going to be a Catholic, I'd be a Jesuit Catholic. And it's really good to be here. We're looking for a productive discussion that can really drive the conversation in D.C. When I first ran for Congress 13 years ago, I asked people in technology, in the area of technology, what is the role of Congress and what should be my role? They said, stay out of the way. And in those days, stay out of the way meant that every time you guys get involved, bad things happen to us. You know, then more things we have to worry about because you don't know what you're doing. You don't understand what you're doing. Things like when Enron happened and people came up with some solution about, this was Oxy-Sarbanes, they had the traditional corporate structure in mind rather than how corporate structures are here or how startups are developed. And so, you know, it wasn't as efficient as it could have been. This area, West, really needs to have a greater presence and influence in what happens in Washington, D.C. Your next round table with Zoe Lofgren and Anna Issue, they're one of the first folks that did things in the area of digital signatures and making those things legal. So I think that this kind of forum and this kind of get-together is going to be really important because the key thing about policy is that we have to know what we're doing. Kind of, don't you think, in policy making. And we should have staff that knows more than policymakers. And that's why, when you look at offices, scan the office and find out who's there, what their background is, and those kinds of things. And, how much do they really understand about the things that you care about. Tim keeps a constant eye on me. And, and then he sifts through all my staff and says, oh, okay, they meet snuff. And so I just want to say thank you to Tim. Joy, who's not here tonight, and Eric in particular, been instrumental in making today go off without a hitch and on time. I want to thank Professor Eric Goldman, who will talk about intellectual property, and then Dana Dittmar, who will talk about education and workforce issues, which is really something that's close to my heart, especially the issue of equity across education. So I just want to just give them a round of applause for being here. As a former classroom teacher, I always felt the most productive sessions occur when there is a two-way dialogue and conversation. So I'm going to be brief and then sit down, because if you want to listen to a conversation, speak on and on and on, you can turn to C-SPAN. So over the past 6 months, Congress has been in debates and have taken action on several critical issues that's really important to Silicon Valley. Some of them, like the recent spectrum auction agreement last month, have potential to drive innovation and our region forward into the 21st century. I was proud to support this agreement. I was particularly heartened to see that the unlicensed spectrum provisions are included, for a lot of reasons, especially as an educator. Other issues like the Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA. When I first heard SOPA, I thought it was a Portuguese word for food, some kind of a SOPA, as it is popularly called. It would have had a profound effect on how the internet functions on a basic level. I strongly oppose this bill, gone so far as to black out my own website in protest. If SOPA had passed, it would have set dangerous precedent and represented a big step backwards in Washington's efforts to foster growth in the digital sector. Thankfully, SOPA has been taken off the table for now, but attempts to limit the internet will not stop. Okay, now taking a long view, I also believe Congress has a responsibility to look at the workforce pipeline that will educate and train innovators of tomorrow. How many of you are law students or students, or graduate students or undergraduate students here at Santa Clara? Watch that corner. How many of you are first generation from your families in the university? Raise your hands. How many of you was born outside of this country? How many of you speak another language other than English? Okay. Good. So we have pretty much of a globalized audience here. So often the focus of our national spotlights is the lack of jobs available to folks in this country. And with your background and your understanding about language, immigration, things like that, a lot of things about immigration and education and high technology, the workforce, H-1B, all those things, you should be dipping into your own experience and asking yourself, is this the most elegant policy possible based upon what I understand my experiences to be? A lot of times we forget to use our own experiences to translate that into analysis and policy making. So for many technology companies here, the problem is just the opposite, not a lack of jobs, but plenty of jobs, but no one to fill them with the necessary skills and to be qualified enough to be hired. And why is this? Part of the reason is that our education system is not producing classroom environments where critical thinking and problem-based learning is valued, and I hope that this will be touching on that. Students don't have to have the necessary skills to thrive in university and career and technical colleges, but I think that all students should have the skills of critical thinking and scientific inquiry. So American students are not producing high marks on international benchmarks, testing science and mathematics education, and we're being outcompeted in global education. I have some thoughts about that, whether we really should worry about that or not. The key is time on task. And if we're asked questions about that, I'd be willing to talk to that. To counteract this kind of a dilemma, I have introduced a bill, the STEM, which is the Science, Technology, Engineering, Mathematics, Education, Innovation Act, to help keep the national focus on STEM education so that we are building up our collective effort to develop a skilled American workforce. But having said that, I think a lot of the focus should be pre-K rather than only K, 6-12. The workforce and labor issues are exacerbated by the fact that our broken immigration system is in place, which is in dire need of reform. And it makes it difficult for high-tech companies to hire skilled workers. As the author of the Reuniting Families Act in Congress, I've also been extremely supportive of efforts in Washington to help skilled workers come to the United States. Through Comprehensive Immigration Reform, or CIR, I believe that we can continue to bring talented minds to Silicon Valley, help grow the U.S. economy, and strengthen our competitiveness in the global markets, and do it in a way where we're not being mean, we're not questioning people's dignity, and that we're attracting people again here to this country to participate. After all, Silicon Valley would not be Silicon Valley without the folks who immigrated here, went to school here, and established themselves here. So we have to stop vilifying this whole issue of immigration and start to look at people as folks who want to come here and participate. So I look forward to discussing all these issues with you here today, SOPA, Spectrum, STEM, and skilled worker immigration. And with that, I'm happy to get started and we'll get on with the program. Who's taking over?
Okay.
Here we go.
Here or up there?
As you try.
How are we doing here? Does this work?
No? You need to
turn, I think
you might have a button.
It
says on.
Just be close to the microphone. It should work fine.
Hello? Nope.
We'll be be able to see you better from up there.
Okay. I'm not sure you really want to see me that bad, but I'll stand up. I might
see on the eye, actually.
Hello, how's that? Well, first of all, thanks to Congressman Honda and to our host, Santa Clara University, for the opportunity to participate in this program. The focus of my brief remarks today will be on the importance of STEM education to workforce development in Silicon Valley. The problem, the miracle of Silicon Valley as a center of innovation and entrepreneurship for the U.S. and the world, is under serious challenge in my view. Why? Because there is a growing shortage of domestically educated, qualified engineers in Silicon Valley and the U.S. The U.S. now ranks 31st among wealthy nations in terms of percentage of high school students at an advanced level of math achievement. Surprisingly also, less than 50% of 12th graders meet the math proficiency benchmark for college readiness. And, perhaps corollary to this, there has been a steady decline over the past 40 years in the percentage of U.S. college graduates choosing to earn science, math, and or engineering undergraduate degrees. The root cause, K-12 STEM education, which provides the foundation for university entrance and ultimate graduation with science, math, and or engineering degrees, is not meeting the need. There is a shortage of fully qualified K-12 STEM teachers, with the result that underprepared teachers with general credentials are pressed into service to teach math and STEM subjects. It is difficult for underprepared teachers, no matter how well intentioned, to inspire young people and effectively teach STEM subjects. And there are also limited opportunities for K-12 students to develop their critical thinking and problem-solving skills in the school environment with the curricula offered. My view, the solution is to increase our focus on STEM education in the U.S., specifically K-12 STEM education. Many of you may be familiar with a study that was done that was initiated by the National Academies of Science, and their report was entitled "Rising Above the Gathering Storm." And the primary first recommendation out of this study was that we must increase America talent pool by vastly improving K-12 science and math education. That's the bottom line. There are two programs, and I want to, with out of respect for Santa Clara University and the wonderful institution it is, I want to prepare you for the fact that I'm going to mention one other university here in the Valley, and that's San Jose State University. And the reason for it, it is also a wonderful university, but it is the source of more than 50% of K-12 teachers in Silicon Valley. And therefore, there are a couple of programs going on there that I think are pivotal in the solution to our K-12 STEM education problems. The first is San Jose State Center for STEM Education. It provides specialized focus on STEM education at the university level for teacher and student preparation and for existing teacher professional development to get their skills to where they need to be so they're better prepared to teach the STEM subjects. The second program is Project Lead the Way, and many of you may have heard of Project Lead the Way. It is being led in Northern California by San Jose State College of Engineering. This program provides middle school and high school students with a unique opportunity to develop their foundation in STEM by working together in teams to solve technical problems and develop product ideas. And this is in middle school and high school. It's project-based, and it, in fact, when it is adopted in schools, it becomes a systemic part of the curriculum. There are now almost 40 schools in Silicon Valley that have this program, thanks to the leadership of the College of Engineering at San Jose State over the last approximately 3 years. There are 3,500 schools across the U.S. that now have this program. Bottom line for me is we don't need to develop new solutions to these problems. We need to get our emphasis and resource behind two proven programs that will help to provide the necessary focus and training on STEM education for teachers and students. Let us take a challenge. Let's move us from 31st in the world to 10th in the world at the advanced level of math achievement by the year 2020. Let's have Silicon Valley lead the way. Thank you.
So let's just switch gears a little bit, have Professor Goldman talk about some of the copyright issues and kind of the legislative discussions over the Stop Online Piracy Act, which the Congressman mentioned. And then we'll go into some Q&A on both STEM and copyright, if that's okay. I know, Eric, with the legislation, it's kind of muted at this point. We don't see it rising from the dead anytime soon. So the actual legislation itself may not be as interesting, but the process whereby you know Silicon Valley got engaged and other folks got engaged, and people from San Francisco got engaged, really is probably what would be really interesting and have the congressman's perspectives on that too. Yeah, please.
Okay. Okay, good. First of all, thank you all for coming here. The State of NetWest program is an essential part of our programmatic offerings for the year. And working with people like Tim and his staff and with the members of Congress and their staff is a joy, and we're grateful for the opportunity to do so. We're especially grateful to Representative Honda for all the work that he does for Santa Clara University across the board and for being here today. And I want to give a shout out to Representative Honda for his leadership on the online copyright battles that we had over the last year or so, for his early opposition to the legislation and for blacking out his website and signaling to the world how deeply he felt about the issues that Congress was debating. The fact that he took such a radical step in how he sent his messages to his constituents of the world, I thought was a real signal that both of his passion, but also of the importance of the matter. Correct me if I'm wrong, that is the only time you've blacked out your website. It showed that this was not an ordinary Congress just doing business as usual type of issue.
Golden Muscle.
But you know what? You'll get the SEU Golden Principled Stance Award. How about that? What happened on January 18th when the legislation, I think for all intents and purposes, died, was really a remarkable day. The stakes at issue were high. We were talking about ways that we would deputize additional parties to become the copyright police. And those people who would become the copyright police might not have the incentives that we would expect them to have if we were trying to maximize social welfare. They might be captured or otherwise motivated to preserve their own self-interest and not the interests of the public at large. The stakes were high because we have the capacity, potentially, with the legislation, to change the fundamental architecture of the internet. We don't really understand why the internet works the way it does. There's something magical about the invisible hand and the ways that people choose to opt into the internet and participate in their own rational self-interest that leads to some greater good. And we have the potential with legislation to change that secret sauce in very critical ways, to undo that invisible hand that we all choose to participate in the internet and make it so that the participation would not be it's seamless or potentially not even possible at all. What happened on January 18th was, a first in so many ways. But what happened is the content owner lobby was defeated on a fair fight. In other words, and you know, had they were fighting hard, opponents are fighting hard, and the copyright owners lost. And it's very hard to point to any other example in history where the copyright owners have lost on a fair fight. And I think that's really a remarkable outcome, something that we're deconstructing today. I know that over the next several years, we'll be having thousands of academic articles. What happened on January 18th? Why did it work or why didn't it work? And what should we do differently? But, you know, think about it as the heavyweight champion, undefeated in a title bout, got knocked out. Unbelievable to have that kind of outcome. But the news is not good. You know, there was a victory in the first skirmish, but the battle is hardly over. And what I'm seeing is that the content owners who suffered their first knockout blow on January 18th said, okay, we don't like that fight. Let's take the fight to other venues where we can win. So what we're seeing is that the content owners are taking the battle anywhere but Congress. They're taking it to the international treaties. And as you know, there are discussions about things like ACTA or the TPP. These are proposals where, through international discussions, the content owners can try and handcuff the United States and get exactly what they were trying to argue for in the legislative battle. The content owners can go to the Department of Justice and say, you've got criminal copyright enforcement powers, go crack some skulls. And we saw that the next day with the Mega Upload prosecution, where Mega Upload putatively qualified for the existing safe harbors, at least for some of their activity, and they're still facing a major criminal prosecution. The content owners are going to the courts, and we've been documenting on my blog case after case where the content owners are getting the same kind of relief that they were asking for in the legislation. So whether we pass a new law or not, if the remedies are the same, what are we fighting about? And then finally, I'll point out that the content owners are taking it to the industry, and they're asking the industry to do their dirty work without any legislative compulsion. So, for example, there's the graduated response, voluntary, and I put that in quotes, the voluntary, because we're holding a gun to your head type of a deal that the Internet Access Providers have struck, where they're going to be the content owner's police. They're going to kick people off the Internet because they think that those individuals are infringing. What this takes to me is that as great as a job as we all did, I think, in fighting the battle on January 18th, what it shows to me is that if what we really need is proactive legislation from Congress that actually ensures some of the rights that we take for granted, that we don't need to scuttle bills that just preserve, when we scuttle them, just preserve the status quo. What we need are more safe harbors and immunities coming from Congress that not only preserve the playing field as we want it to be, but make sure that none of these underground end around runs work, that they actually keep the courts from doing what we don't want them to do, or keep the voluntary industry organizations from doing things that we don't want to do, or deflect some of the efforts of these international treaties. So I put out the challenge to Congress that if they want to actually make the difference now, the next step is for them to actually go proactively guarantee our rights as users and consumers of the Internet, not simply scuttle bills that would have taken those away. So now I'm going to tell you how I really feel.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure. Do you have a roving mic?
No, I don't. Well, I don't. But,
okay. Go ahead.
So, I mean, you were talking about the graduated response, memorandum of understanding between the ISPs and the content community. Are you saying that that is not a positive development in the light that, as far as we can tell, is largely voluntary? It's largely industry working together to address the problem. And so far, no ISPs have said they'd actually terminate anyone's service. Is that, you know, is that a good outcome in light of the fact that it could have been legislative, like Adobe in France or in London, they had legislation in Hong Kong as well? So I'm kind of curious about your...
Yeah, so in 1998, Congress enacted the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and as part of that enacted 17 U.S.C. 512A, that said that Internet access providers are not liable for infringement that takes place over their network. This is different from web hosts or other types of intermediaries, but Internet access providers are not liable for copyright infringement. That law is very clear. And yet, the same Internet access providers have entered into an agreement with content owners to go and police their network and terminate or otherwise degrade the subscription rights of their consumers voluntarily. Now, why would the Internet access providers choose to do that if they already had legislative protection that said they weren't liable in the first place? Now, one answer is that they are trying to actually act as good Samaritans. They're trying to clean up the Internet. Another is that something funny is going on, and I think there's a number of hypotheses, what kind of funny things might be going on. I'm happy to explore those if you want. The problem with this quote voluntary solution is that it doesn't build in the legislative protections that we expect as consumers. So, for example, there's a series of iterative steps of discipline that the internet access providers have agreed upon to punish rogue subscribers. Those procedures don't follow standard due process. There's an expedited adjudicative process that doesn't come anywhere close to the kinds of standards we would expect that can lead to the termination of someone's internet access account. Now, we haven't seen that as the final outcome. I don't know why we would have any other solution than termination, so I continue to believe that's going to be the ultimate payoff. We'll have to see about that. So the lack of due process is a serious problem. The other problem is that there's no transparency into the process whatsoever. We don't get the kind of stats to see what kinds of algorithms are automatically detecting that someone's engaged in copyright infringement, or what kinds of outcomes are going to occur in this process. All this takes place in a big black box. Remember, all this is in contrast to what would have happened under default rules as enacted by Congress, 17 U.S.C. 512A, that says that if the content owners objected to these subscribers' activity, they couldn't sue the internet access providers, they would have to sue the individual in court. And in court, then, we would have had transparency. We would have seen what those cases look like. And we would have also had all the standard due process that we expect from our judicial system. That's why I object to the, quote, voluntary agreement.
Did you notice that the advisory board for the copyright MOU group was just announced? And my boss, Jerry Berman, was on that advisory council, as is G.D. Sum. Does that give you any feel better about that?
Yeah, so there's a new organization that's designed to act as the coordinator of all this activity. And that organization has a series of governing bodies. One of them is a advisory board of external constituents that appointed some real leaders in our field, people like Gigi, people like Jerry Berman, people like Jules Poleski. People who have done a lot of good work on behalf of consumers. Someone like Gigi is not easily bought off, for example. I'm guessing she'll be throwing punches. My concern is, however, that the advisory board has given no real power in dictating any of the problems I have. They can't ensure due process. They cannot ensure transparency. They will get a voice at the table, but to what effect, we are unsure. So the fact that they appointed, I think, a robust board is a good step, but it doesn't actually fix the underlying structure.
Can I ask a question to Congressman? Now, let's ask all my questions. I apologize. On your STEM proposal and specifically immigration reform, out here it seems like there's just broad consensus that we should have H-1B visas and STEM visas for high-skilled workers and engineering students and things like that. But in Washington, in your bio, I forgot to mention that for your Democratic caucus, you're a senior whip. And it's common knowledge in Washington that the H-1B visa, the STEM visa issue, seems to be held up by the larger debate over immigration reform. So it seems like it's hard to get any specific H-1B, high-tech visa proposal through unless the entire immigration reform goes through, which is holding up one of your major initiatives. And, as a leader in the Democratic caucus, can you kind of explain that and what your hopes are for maybe getting around that kind of larger all-or-nothing approach?
Well, the good question, by the way. Thank you. And that's what you asked it. I think the H-1B and STEM should be all part of the outcome of a Comprehensive Immigration Reform Act. In the past, what we've done is we piecemeal a lot of our policies and patchworked it. And so we end up with Frankenstein. And when we were working on the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Act about 4 or 5 years ago, we determined, we meaning the caucus, the Latino caucus, some members of the Asian caucus, and the African-American caucus, the Black caucus, the Progressive caucus, we felt that if we allowed the immigration issue to be piecemealed through, the easy stuff gets through. Or the easy stuff that has a lot of popularity in certain sectors or have a lot of special interest groups that have a lot of sway on Congress will get through. And then the rest of the stuff, the hard stuff, like how do you deal with the undocumented population, the illegal population? What does the undocumented population look like? Are they folks who came with visas and then allowed it to expire? And all these kinds of things would not be addressed or solved. And I think that the only compromise that we came up with was with the DREAM Act kids, that they were on the, in terms of the list of priorities, in terms of wanting to keep them, they were high on the list. The in terms of them being the most problematic, the DREAM Act kids was the least problematic. And so that was a compromise that we wanted to put out there and to have considered, given the politics of comprehensive immigration reform. H-1B is a solution to a problem that's been spread out to a lot of different areas. And I support H-1B visa if we can move it towards a better system where those who are H-1B visa holders have some options. Before, they just had limited options. They had very, very tight regulations in terms of who's the sponsor. The sponsor decided that they don't need them anymore. They're gone. There's no portability in there. So there's a lot of things that were problematic for me in the beginning. And I sort of looked at it as if it were a high-tech coolie system where we brought on workers that was cheaper, skilled, and necessary, but only for a certain amount of time. It's a harsh terminology, but you know, with my background as an Asian American in this country and in the state, I understand how people can be used for the purposes of economic viability. On the STEM, it's important, but I think it needs to be extended to pre-K and not only 6 to 12. Because I'm concerned about the youngsters that fall out, that spin out, that lose interest in science because we haven't figured out how to let them know that no matter what their background is or the situation, they're doing science every day. We just don't put the science terminology in what they do, like oil and egg. You change the state of water, you change, you're denaturizing the proteins in an egg. But they don't say it that way. It's a boiled egg, you know. And if they understood that that was all science, then they might be able to feel like they can do these kinds of things and not feel outside. So language and instruction is important. Now, the overall comprehensive immigration reform has implications in every walk of life in our country. There's part of it is the Reuniting Families Act, where we have citizens who are applying for reunification with their loved ones. And sometimes they have to wait 20 years before they can get it. And if the immigration office loses the paper, it's not their fault. It's the applicant's fault, and they got to refile again and get to the end of the line. Some wait 10, 20 years, and then when their minor children become adults, then they got to do it all over again. And the only thing I added to the Reuniting Families Act was to make sure that it was truly comprehensive. What I mean by that is to add to the platform another plank, and those are binational, same gender couples and their families. And that would make it truly comprehensive. But that would be a hard one to pass if it were not all inside of a complete package. So that's why, you know, I'm sticking to a larger comprehensive package that we really hammer out all these things so that it will be a document and a process that we'd be proud of. If our immigration system were a store like a clothing store, we certainly would not have a reputation like Nordstrom's or Neiman Marcus, you know, where the customer's right, exchange your materials without question. And so that's point where we have to get at and put the politics aside and just really hammer out a good policy for people. Long answer, sorry.
I'd like to, if I could, offer a few comments, but there we go. I'm just going to use it this way. First of all, having spent almost 40 years in high-tech industry in Silicon Valley, and have been a hirer, if you will, an employer of a large number of employees from outside the U.S., when we were faced with the dilemma that there weren't sufficient available degreed engineers to hire and let, you know, accept the ones on their H-1B visa. And I can guarantee you they were hired under the same compensation structure as every other employee. We did not have two compensation structures. We treated these employees like all of our other employees, and we benefited from their creativity, and ultimately, most or many of them became green card and then ultimately citizens of the United States. The other thing that's really important for us to keep in mind on immigration, I think, is that the miracle of Silicon Valley, certainly driven by K-12 education, has been also driven by this great source of immigrant talent that has come in and started companies and led divisions of existing companies. So we are enriched in this country by constructive immigration, and this diverse Silicon Valley is an example of that. So I think it's really important we don't forget that. The other thing I'd like to briefly comment on is it's not SOPA, but it is intellectual property protection. The U.S. and U.S. companies are under attack continually from competitors outside this country who are both customers and then become competitors because they start copying products and so on and so forth. And we really need to have strong emphasis in legislation and enforcement and prevent products coming into this U.S. that in fact are copies or the result of copied technology, you know, second generation, that end up undermining the competitiveness of U.S. companies and effectively taking jobs out of this country. So those are two things that I think that are really important to industry. I see it all the time. I'm still active. I consult for a number of high-tech companies. And intellectual property protection against foreign national companies, some very, very large companies that I won't name, and enforcement of intellectual property protection is just extremely difficult. And even in those countries, they have laws that mimic the U.S. IP protection and enforcement laws. And then when you get into the courts to protect your IP, it somehow gets thrown out or nothing happens in the courts in the country in question. So we have serious problems in that area, separate from K-12 education. You know, I'm a proponent of K-12 STEM education. It is so important to our future, and it applies to minorities, it applies to majorities, it applies to all of our diverse population. We need to strengthen STEM education so that we can continue the miracle of Silicon Valley and continue to have this be the center of entrepreneurship and innovation in the world.
About STEM, you mentioned the STEM visa program. Is there a visa program that's supposed to bring in K-12 STEM teachers as opposed to engineers once they're already advanced? And if there was such a program, given that Mr. Dimore was saying there's such an emergency situation, would you see that as something you would support? My concern, I mean, I completely understand the need for comprehensive reform, but, you know, there's the cliche about the perfect being the enemy of the good sometimes, and if there are programs that could, in piecemeal fashion, help, would you still feel like you'd rather hold off on those?
I don't know if there's an H-1B program for STEM teachers, but let me just go back to the phrase, don't make perfection the enemy of the good. I get it. But how long are we going to keep from addressing the real problem? That's, you know, to fix the problem in its entirety. And if Congress can't get it and understand it, and they use policies and politics and fear, you know, I don't put up with that. I went through it as a community and in this country. I've seen this country go through periods of fear, fear-mongering, and trying to develop different kinds of policies. And I think that that's all part of the politics today. You know, we focus on the border. Has anybody been at the border and understand what's going on? We got more law enforcement in Nogales, the Los Dos Nogales. They're the safest place because they got so many law enforcement folks there. You know, it's between the urban areas where it's dangerous. Stem cell, you know, education is really basic in this country, but is it equitable? Why are we have 50 states battling every year over a budget, and when they balance the budget, it's over education. Who's victimized? Parents, teachers, and most of all, our clients, the youngsters. Now, the report, the gathering, Rising Above the Gathering Storm, was mentioned. There's a one before that, you know, A Nation at Risk. And the two had the same kinds of outcomes, you know. But there's always one silver lining in those reports. The Nation at Risk said, if any country came to this country and imposed a mediocre education system, we would consider that an act of war. Well, we don't have to worry about other countries. We're doing it to ourselves. And Khrushchev said, I don't have to attack you, you're going to just implode. I don't think he thought about that, but essentially, we are deteriorating internally. And the lack of science teachers and lack of STEM kids, it's the adults that need to understand that this is necessary, that we have to invest in our country. We have to start with stand back and ask ourselves, is it good policy to have the states have the sole responsibility of education just because it's said in the Constitution? What the Constitution says, that which is not explicit shall be the purview of the states. It didn't say exclusivity. It didn't say anything that, you know, that it excluded the federal government, because at that time there was no education system. Commerce, post office, the military, all those things existed because that was the state of the art until Carter came along and said, we're going to have something here. So we have to grow up and mature at the same time as policymakers and stop fighting among ourselves, because our kids, their civil rights are being violated. And the only thing they have, only thing that kids have to spend when they go to school, the only currency they have is time. You can't bank it and withdraw later with interest. It's spent. Now, every parent and every adult in this country should be alarmed and angry about that. But it's not the kids' fault. It's not immigrants' fault. It's not poor people's fault. It's policymakers who don't understand the question, why are there poor schools in poor neighborhoods? How do you create communities? What are those things that drive those things ultimately? We tried desegregation, now we resegregated. So therefore, something is missing. It's the issue of equity for each child. So I think in education, in STEM especially, we have to start talking in policy language. Instead of saying, all children deserve an equal rights, an equal opportunity in education in this country, we should say, each child has a right to equitable education according to their needs. Solutions that will change, wouldn't it? So it's a challenge, I think, that we all have, and not looking outside and figuring out it must be that, it must be this, you know. I understand that we're behind in the competition with other countries, but they spend more time per day on instruction, and how much do we spend? So there's a lot of things that we have to look at ourselves first. Sorry, it takes long.
Hello, my name is Gabrielle Zuccarelli. I'm from Santa Clara Law. This question is for the Congressman, building off of what you just said. You know, implementing STEM in K through 12 is clearly going to cost quite a bit of money, I'm assuming, in science and math. It requires materials, books, items for laboratory testing, all of that. So, you know, I come from Arizona originally, and talking about the legislature being difficult.
Welcome to California.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. And so with that said, you know, how does DC see this in seeing that there are state legislatures that don't support education? And how is, you know, these huge budget cuts that are going towards K through 12? How is that going to impact how we are effectively, you know, implementing STEM in the future? And how do we, you know, get the message across? I was a former lobbyist, a student lobbyist with, you know, the Arizona legislature, and, you know, there were people there who didn't want to hear anything we had to say in regards to education. So how do we get the message across?
Yeah. I'll let him speak after. I'll be brief. Solving the education problem is expensive. But if we're going to look at mediocrity, and if mediocrity were imposed by another country on us would be considered an act of war, then we should be in battle. I don't like the word war in terms of kids and education, but the proposition I'm suggesting, that each child needs should be addressed rather than all children, would change the solution set, but it's going to be expensive. But not much more expensive than going to war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, where we have spent $1 trillion in servicing that debt of $800 billion. That's enough money to get started in changing the concept. If all children can learn, then children in Appalachia and Beverly Hills should have the same opportunity. They may have different issues, but they should have the same opportunity. And if we believe in equal rights, then we should believe in equity for each child in education. And that's an investment we have to make. The bumper sticker says, what is the price of ignorance? And we see it every year in every legislature. Yeah, including Congress.
I'm really a supporter of Congressman Honda and the initiative that he's driven on STEM education, and I really think he was such a right thinker in this area. But I think we need a bridge, and the bridge is corporations need to help us with this problem. And in the case of Project Lead the Way, Project Lead the Way in Silicon Valley, we've got over $1 million in commitments for Project Lead the Way from corporations, corporations like Xilinx and KLA Tencor and others. Similarly, the STEM Education Center at San Jose State has corporate sponsors, and we have almost $1 million in commitments. And so industry needs to help bridge, but we need to change our tax structure. You know, we failed our students. I voted for Proposition 13 back in the late 70s, early, I don't even remember what year it was. I damn myself every day for that. We went from 78, thank you, Mike. We went from being in the top 10 states in the country on dollars spent per K-12 student each year, and we're something like 48th now. We have, you know, committed a grave, you know, disservice to our young people. And me, why am I in this? I'm in it for my grandkids. You know, I want them to have the same opportunity I did, because I grew up in California at a time when we were in the top 10 in the country. So industry has to help with a bridge, but government needs to change the tax structure so that we funnel the education resources where they need to be.
Hi, Joyce Cutler, I'm a reporter for BNA. I want to go back to the days of the DMCA when it was first passed, and the many bright minds were concerned that the DMCA would be used as a bludgeon against people. And I'm wondering, since we haven't really fixed the problems of the DMCA specifically, how it's being used against people for creativity, how that works with protecting intellectual property now. Specifically, if we can't fix what was passed many years ago, how do we fix it now?
Yeah.
Joyce, I'm not totally clear on where you're going. I mean, I could go on and on with the deficiencies of the online safe harbors in 17 U.S.C. 512.
Well, it's about how people are using the MCA for what was not intended purposes.
Can you give me a paradigmatic example that's on your mind?
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking of like the many times the Modern Frontier Foundation has to send letters for to companies that are threatening people for using company names as a trademark violation when it's just free speech matters, let's say on blogs or wherever.
Yeah, well, the trademark isn't covered by 17 U.S.C. 512, so that sometimes we do see people who misuse the 17 U.S.C. 512(c)(3) takedown procedures that are designed to cover copyright complaints, and they use them for trademark purposes. We've definitely seen that. But let's step back for a moment. I've said many critical things of the balance that was struck in 1998 and the online safe harbors. But the reality is that it has not been a fatal impediment to the development of the user-generated content community. Now, some companies have gotten driven out of the industry by the misuse of the tools in the safe harbor. And so, for example, my paradigmatic example of that is Veo, which the Ninth Circuit said was eligible for 17 U.S.C. 512(c) protection, and yet the copyright owners were able to bleed it dry with legal fees and kicked it out of the marketplace nonetheless. So it was legal, but still dead. That's I think, a good misuse situation. But overall, if you step back, I mean, we've had an enormous amount of entrepreneurial activity in the user-generated content space, predicated on the assumption that there's a notice and takedown scheme. If there's problems with copyright infringing material on the site, that the copyright owners will communicate that to the site. The site will respond expeditiously. And that balance has led to the ability of people to make investments. And that was one of the main things that was at risk in the SOPA proposal, is that there was bypasses to that notice and takedown scheme. There wasn't going to be the same opportunity for a website to fix the problem that they had under the current solution. So I guess, Joyce, I'm still stuck on your predicate assumption. I'd love to fix a lot of the problems with the DMCA online safe harbors, but to me, the more pressing need is to fix some of the things that we're seeing in these other battlegrounds, that the DMCA has worked effectively enough to make it so that people could do what we want them to do. But I'm not sure that's how responsible to you, but I'm curious if you have thoughts about that too.
I'll speak in the context of my own experience and my own understanding. I guess when people are looking for solutions from policymakers, I would really shudder, and you should be watching us very carefully, because a lot of us don't understand what the hell you just said. And then we're going to pretend that we knew, and then we're going to try to fix it. And you end up with a mess. That's why in the beginning when I said, when I asked people, what's the role of policymakers, they just stay out of our way. But the real answer should have been, we need to get together, you need to understand what we do, and you need to understand how it's done, how things get done in Congress or any policymaking level. So there's a lot of educating for all of you who are thought leaders. And thought leaders are going to have to really become, I think, conceptually broader in your thinking, so that everything you do within that concept will start to make sense. When we start to solve problems, in different areas, it creates other problems in other areas. And I think we just got to get past this linear thinking and become more conceptual and web-like in our thinking. And having said that, it sort of brought to mind, I said kiddingly once, that the problem that the Native Americans had in this country was they had no concept of land ownership. So when Europeans came over, even if Asians came over, they had a concept of land ownership, and that determined class and everything else like that. The sharing of land and the stewardship of land was a foreign concept to Asia and to Europe, but not to those who were here. And when those two clashes, someone loses, and we know who lost. And so I think that we need to start to understand and conceptualize is there due process, you know, is there transparency? The things that Eric had brought up, you know, these kinds of things are necessary in policymaking so that we take care of people and we take care of the consumer. And right now, we forget sometimes the consumer, and we make decisions in Congress based upon who has the most influence. A lot of times it's about market share, not about consumer protection.
So let me bring it back to the STEM education question, but slightly different angle. It strikes me that there's an aspect of the STEM education problem that we've been not talking about at all, and that is actually fundamental science funding and the role of science in our society. When I was growing up, I know when Dana was growing up, science was the sexy thing. It was the next frontier. I mean, that was where we were all gonna, that was what drove our curiosity as kids, and we pursued it. Today, there's a war on science among the policymakers. There's denial of science, there's cutting of funding of science, there's cutting of funding of major engineering programs. The role of federal government in funding curiosity-driven or speculative R&D has been reduced, and I worry that we could hope all we want to that we can improve the STEM education system, but if kids aren't drawn into science, if they don't see the opportunity, if they aren't excited by the choices, the curiosity, we're not going to drive them there. What can we do to educate our policymakers, because I think it is an education process, and to get them to better understand the importance of science and the scientific method, if you will, in our 21st century society?
I guess that's to me, huh? I'm prejudiced, okay? You're going to have to change the policymakers. If they don't understand, they don't learn, you got to change them. But because in Congress they come from, the people elect them, so maybe there's got to be a more basic education in terms of how do you bring it home to folks who are putting policymakers who are there against their own self-interest, against the self-interest of their children's children, seven generations now. I mean, coming here this morning, I was listening to the demise of polar bears. There's 25,000 left. Some people, that's a whole lot of bears. And, you know, and it's all centered around the ice melt in the Arctic. And so we have to really have a major pushing, making, you know, everybody understand the severity of not having a good understanding of what's going on, what we're doing to our own environment now. If the Chinese are doing it, then why are they doing it? I mean, yeah, they're polluting, but at the same time, they're trying to make corrective stuff. So, you know, they must understand something. We don't have a national policy that drives the entire country forward on global warming. South Korea, when I was there, they made a statement, green growth. And everybody at every level was moving on it. In our country, we have a lot of self-interest and we forgot about our responsibility to the whole community and the whole globe. It's like pretending that this globe is the spaceship enterprise. You know? We have a certain principle that we're going to operate by, and we haven't gotten to it yet. And, so, I didn't answer your question, but I think that it's going to be an issue of educating folks. Maybe this way. In the 50s, we did not know there were states that existed that had policies about separate but equal. It was working there, but the rest of the country didn't know until TV came along and we started seeing the atrocities and the kinds of way people were being treated and how they were being pounded down. It's an issue of power and control. And when the rest of the country and the world saw it through TV, we became incensed. So it drove our politicians through public will to change it. When Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he said, we're going to lose the Democrats from the South. And he was right, but he did the right thing. So maybe it's about, you know, each one to each one, each one to each one. be getting back to the old mantra of the 60s.
Mark, thanks for your question. You know, one of the things that strikes me about public office, and I have great respect for people like Congressman Honda, who's devoted his life to public service. But when we started our corporate life, Mark, the first thing our corporation did was put us in a training program. Taught us how to be good engineers. Then ultimately they taught us how to be managers and what have you. And I don't see any evidence at the local, state, or federal level that we put our new congressmen, senators, what have you, into training programs to learn their job. How do we do our job? How do we do it better? And you know, as part of such a development program, we could include science education as part of that, and the importance of it to the economy. That's just a wild hair idea. I mean, I'm going to make one more comment. And, you know, Mark stood up and asked his question. And I said earlier that one of the things that can help us as a transition is bridging support from industry. And Mark was chief technical officer of Symantec, is now chief technical officer of Neustar. But he's been one of those corporate executives in the Valley that has supported STEM education and done it with putting his money where his mouth is. Thank you, Mark, for what you do.
We'll take one last question. Looks like we have it over there.
Hi, Congressman. I just wanted to thank you for taking time out to speak to us today. My name is Judy Wang. I'm actually a recent graduate of the MIT Technology and Policy Program, and I grew up in the Bay Area and moved back home to pursue an opportunity in an early stage startup specializing in health IT. My question actually is, what do you think the role of the government is in cultivating innovation and entrepreneurship? And on the flip side, what do you think our role as tech innovators in the Valley is for keeping innovation and entrepreneurship in the public consciousness and pushing this agenda forward?
Can I ask you a question first?
Sure.
What were you thinking when you were formulated that question? It'll help me sort of respond.
So actually in March, I went to the South by Southwest conference, and there was a lot of discussion around the Startup Act, the Jobs Bill, and Senator Jerry Moran was talking about pushing that through Congress. And a lot of tech innovators were concerned about that there wasn't really a culture of innovation and entrepreneurship being pursued by the United States. And
sure.
What is our role as young innovators in cultivating that and making sure it's okay to tell graduates of places like MIT and like Stanford and Berkeley that it's okay to go into entrepreneurship and it's great to start your own business. And if your business fails, how do you make sure that they don't just decide not to start another business?
Yeah, thank you. You used a word innovation, and a fellow by the name of Cody Shimura said to me, Mike, you gotta push teaching innovation. And I asked them, a CEO who retired and who was one of the leaders in one of these studies, national studies. So what do you think about teaching innovation? And he said, it's pretty hard. I mean, that's kind of innate. You know, how do you take something that's in somebody else and teach that? Well, he asked him, a teacher, and I know how to do that. We put a bill together saying, you know, it's how do we teach and put together a group that will extract skills and insights of people who had the highest amount of patents, go to them and try to extract those skills, and then turn them into teaching units in terms of how you can teach innovation. You know, and it can be fun. You know, I used to ask my science kids, so how would life be different if your eyeballs were at the end of your index fingers? And once they got started, it was really hilarious, but they were starting to think outside the box. You know, you can't pick your nose, you can't pick your ears, mom shakes her finger, she gets a headache, you know, all those kinds of things. But it's about teaching innovation and being an entrepreneur. I have my chief ledge person is a graduate from MIT. He's got a PhD. He taught, and his PhD was in material science. But it was his social consciousness that brought him to work in policy. So terms like democratization of energy became a theme in our office, trying to figure out how we get energy to every household in every home in the world. Because the sun is ubiquitous. And how do you convert that and drive innovation and drive, put monies into thoughts and research in that area so that we ultimately drive ourselves to a point where we're not dependent upon petroleum, but really become sustainable and self-sustaining on things that everybody can get access to. And so I think it's a good thing to be that, because it's that kind of thinking that drives other people to think beyond their own box that they've been taught in. You know, as we grow up, we're taught barriers. A child, when they're born, they're looking at everything, putting everything in their mouth, touching everything. And then as they grow older, we give them barriers. We say, no. And pretty soon they grow up, you know, pretty much focused on certain kinds of things and not looking at everything else. So I'm not sure that answers your question, but I really want to push the concept of learning, innovation, but also consider what the hell happened in the past. When I talk about the Indians and the immigrants coming here, I'm serious. I'm talking about the kinds of things that have driven our country to a point where global warming is now a problem. Why? Because property, consumption, my stuff versus your stuff, power and control all become prominent rather than protecting the individuals. The kinds of concepts that we have in our Constitution, the kinds of things that you mentioned. So as policymakers, we really have to be the caretakers and the gatekeepers of people's rights and the consumers' rights.
Let me just add that in many parts of the country, working for established players is viewed as the prestige job for graduates of undergraduate, whereas here in Silicon Valley, I think that working for startups is viewed as the prestige job, that you go to the incumbents if you couldn't get the job in the startup, whereas it's the vice versa in most parts of the country. That's one of the reasons why there's such a strong ethos here in Silicon Valley. Get the legislatures out of the way so they don't lock in the incumbents, create the room for the startups so that we can continue to have those jobs that we value as graduates. But we are out of time, and I do want to thank all of you for coming and joining us today. As I mentioned, the State Net West program is our flagship event that we have throughout the year, so we do hope you'll come and join us at some of the other offerings. I want to thank Dana Ditmore for joining us here. I also want to thank Representative Hanna for taking the valuable time and for his staff to come in and help put this event together. We're very grateful to have opportunities to share time with Representative Hanna and to have him back on campus. So thank you very much for coming today.